He had been the chairman of a department. Now, this was at the University of Iowa in Iowa City, not Ames. Mm-hmm. And I remember when she came up here and interviewed before she took the position of what was then director of home economics. I walked across the campus with her and showing her around, and she said, well, I'd like to get into one of these land grant schools, I guess. And she had made that comment to a colleague in another state who reported to Dean Christensen, who was then Dean of the College of Agriculture, that she thought Frances Zuhl might be interested, and that was the reason she was approached. She made that same comment. She did say, as I was showing her around, she said, your lack of facilities is what worries me. And she came here and got them.
Did something about it.
Yes.
She must have established some reputation for herself then before she was...
Oh, indeed she had. She had her master's degree from home economics supervisor in the Baltimore schools. And at that time, even their teachers' meetings had been segregated. There are many blacks in Baltimore. Frances Zuhl said, no, we will meet together. She went from there. She had teaching experience before she got her master's degree. In fact, I think she was a two-year graduate at Stout, and then went to Columbia, where she finished her bachelor's and got a master's. But in the meantime, she had taught.
I see. So
I think her father had not approved of home economics, and so she had said, I'll pay for it myself, something like that. There was something like that about her taking home economics, that she'd teach and pay for it herself.
She sounds like a determined woman.
Oh, indeed she was. But then she went to be the chairman of the department at the University of Iowa. And incidentally, I remember saying to her that I knew when that department was established. It was established when I was in school at Ames, and I think a junior. And when I said that to her, she said, well, you're really dating yourself. And I said, yes, I know, but I graduated in 1914, so why worry? At any rate, there was a move on the part of the Iowa legislature to take home economics from Ames to Iowa City, where there were more girls whom they thought should have an opportunity to take some home economics. And the legislators were saying, all of these girls, and they should have some home economics, and so we'll just take the home economics from Ames to Iowa City. Then there was a school of engineering at Iowa City and at Ames, and we'll bring the engineers from Iowa City to Ames, and to save this duplication. Well, we organized by counties. Every county had a chairman, and you know who was chairman of our county. And we were so busy keeping the girls at Ames, it's a wonder we didn't flunk out. Writing to our legislators, writing home to, and just generally objecting to any move. And I can remember, we wouldn't think of going to the university from Ames. We were arch enemies. And my mother said, well, Iowa City's nearer home, that'd be fine. Why? I said, I wouldn't go to Iowa City. I'll go to Kansas to finish home economics, if they take home economics to Iowa City. That was just, we were all planning where we'd go, and we'd either go to Illinois or Kansas. We'd go to Iowa City. Well, anyway, as if they finally didn't do it. And In due time, Frances Sewell was brought from Baltimore to Iowa City to be chairman of the department which they established there, which was small but very good. But never, Ames dominated home economics, I think still does, in the state of Iowa, without a doubt. And they did establish home economics to train teachers at Iowa State Teachers, so-called college then, it's something else now, but at Cedar Falls, Iowa, too. Mm-hmm. Incidentally, B. Geiger went from here to be head of the home economics at Cedar Falls before she went to the University of Indiana. Well, anyway, that was Frances Sewell's history, and then came here from Iowa City. And some of her Iowa City friends said that she hadn't anything left to fight for there. So she was ready to move.
Oh, that's
she
scary.
Gotten everything she wanted there. So she was, and in stature, she was the direct opposite. She, Ms. Sewell was very short. I don't know what her height was. I think under 5 feet. She tended to be a little chunky. With that height, it was difficult not to be. But she was just as different from in stature she could be. And she was different in other ways.
From Miss Marlott.
Yes, as a person. I happened to know Sewell very well, not happened. I taught under her here, and then we lived together and worked together in Pakistan for 2 years. So we knew one another pretty well. In contrast to Miss Marlatt's crusty exterior, Frances Sewell was a very approachable person. I don't think students ever thought of being afraid of her. She was very chatty, very easy. But she was, I would have to say, less generous than Miss Marlatt. And a little tougher. She had this easy manner to begin with, but she was could be pretty tough. Well, of course, Abby could too, but after you got past her crusty exterior, she was pretty much of a marshmallow. And Frances Sewell had this easy approach, and then she was stern.
Quite the reverse, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, they were just as different as they could be, and yet they both had their strong points.
Well,
Frances Sewell was at one time president of the American Home Economics Association. Abby never was, and I think it was a big disappointment in her life. It was because of this. People thought she'd be very hard to work with. I don't think she would have been. But they never would put her into that office because they thought she'd be hard to work with. I know when a woman who had been executive secretary came here to be on the staff later, and she said, I think she should have been made a president of AHA at some time. And they had said, would you want to work with her? And she had said, I would be willing to work with her as executive secretary. But she was never, she had a rough manner, there's no denying it, and it was not, people didn't think she was easy to get along with. I never had any problem. Well, I wouldn't say I had no problems, but then nothing.
Oh, well, there are always problems with everybody.
Because I wasn't afraid of her. But you always have problems. I had problems with Frances Sewell, but you learn how to handle them. You have problems with any administrator, unless you're just a, I don't know what kind of person it takes to avoid problems.
Now, what kind did you have with Frances Sewell?
Well, I can't think now, really. She was very much the director. I have often said these were not personal problems of mine, but we had, Missoula made a great point of the democratic procedure. And we had staff meetings where problems of the school were discussed, but it always seemed to me that we never got through with them until we had finally voted to do what she wanted to do. You know, you never got it settled until it was settled the way she wanted it. That was her democratic procedure.
I see.
And she was, you know, that, in spite of her easy manner, she was something of a dictator. She wanted things the way she wanted them. And I think that sometimes, I guess, was a personal problem.
Could have.
By and large, we got along very well. We lived together and worked together for 2 years and had these, traveled together, went, you know, all over that part of the world whenever we could. And in general, it was a very good opportunity.
You mentioned staff meetings.
Of the home economics faculty here.
Yes, I understand. Mm-hmm. Did you have some kind of similar meetings when Abby Merlatt was head?
I don't think we did. Not that included the whole faculty. And I was a lowly instructor or whatever while she was here. I don't know that I was, I guess I did get to be maybe an assistant professor. I don't know the dates of my own
promotions.
I had them somewhere once because occasionally you have to have had to use them, but
a matter of record anyway.
Yes, I think things were settled by a small group, pretty much. I don't remember. Now, with Miss Zuhl, we had these lengthy meetings when students' recommendations had to be done. And we worked over them as a whole staff. Now, I don't know what we did about them when Miss Marlatt was the director. See, during Ms. Zuhl's regime here, we became a school. We were a department in the College of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And we became a school, which was very little different, except then eventually we had departments within the school. I say in a way they reverted. We have a school, but they don't have departments. But they have subject matter areas, and I'd like to know how they differ from departments. My daughter happens to be chairman of one of them, and I say, well, what is that but a department? It's about the same thing, but they call it something different. And well, anyway, where were we?
Well, we were sort of contrasting.
Yes, well, I think that, as I said, I would have to say that Frances Zuhl was less generous in some respects, definitely, than Abby. Frances Zuhl was Scotch, and occasionally it showed through. She did not make the big contributions to Omicron Nu that Abby made. And in one's own personal dealings with her, she was honest but never went overboard. Which is all right. She was, and you would occasionally get a word of praise from Abby. Never from Frances Zuhl. The Scots showed through there. Literally, different people, I mean, Coles would say, well, it's the Scotch of it. Now, Abby had a way of, I remember having, she did sit in on occasional lectures in a course that I was involved in. And if she liked your lecture, she kind of had a little gesture that showed her approval. Mm-hmm. As I said, she said, when I decided I wanted to work for my PhD, she hoped it wouldn't spoil a good teacher. Mm-hmm. Well, Frances Sewell just couldn't tell you to your face that you had done a good job. She would say to, May Coles would say, well, May Reynolds did thus and so, you know, and did it well, and May would come and tell me.
I see.
But she didn't say it to me.
How about criticism? Would she criticize you to your face?
No, I guess not. Oh, yes, occasionally. I can't just think of any instance, certainly not that I was above criticism. But by the time she was here, I had matured. I was pretty much going my own way, I guess. I would say that she helped me get research funds, and I know that she was the one, you know, you don't get honors or awards unless someone decides that you ought to have them and does a little something about it. And I know that she was the person who got people started writing letters when I got the Borden Award for Nutrition Research. I know that she did that. Now, I shouldn't say that she's not generous. Mm-hmm. Oh, she teased me that when the night that award was made, it was at a big evening meeting, and of course I had to make a response. And I left the podium after I'd made my response and left the check right, you get $1,000 when you get the Borden Award, along with a gold medal, which incidentally I guess now is worth as much as the check. Anyway, I walked away from the podium and left my check. She never quit kidding me about that. I got it.
You got it.
But I knew that, I know that she went all out to get that for me. Well, like you said, I got back to myself very easily.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine, too.
That was one of the very nice things that happened to me. And I would have to say I would have to thank her for that, I think.
Now, one of the things that just in going back and thinking about the Home Economics Department as it developed, my impression is that its early emphasis really was heavy on the side of pure science.
It was heavy on the side of foods and nutrition. Abby was a chemist to begin with, and a food and nutrition person. She never got over being that. And in that, I think for that reason, and there are others too, but foods and nutrition developed here considerably more than the other areas in the earlier days. Foods and nutrition now, unfortunately, in my view, has left home economics here, but that's another story. It's not my story. But Abby was helped to develop strong foods and nutrition, and of course, foods and nutrition had research money and research projects long before any research had developed in the other areas, not only here, but anywhere. It was, there were experiment station funds for foods and nutrition when there were no funds for family economics or clothing and textiles or art, you know, any of those, any of the other areas that we think of as belonging within the areas of home economics.
Oh, I see.
And that was true anywhere and everywhere. But I think particularly here, partly because that was Abby's main interest.
So that emphasized this trend, mm-hmm. did it?
Mm-hmm. She had traveled a good deal. She had some beautiful paintings in her apartment. She was not without her interest in art. but it had not developed to the same extent that, but again, it was partly the whole area and the fact that there were federal funds for foods and nutrition research and for long before there were funds for anything else.
So in a sense she made the most of that opportunity.
Yeah, that's right.
It just happened to reinforce her own interests.
Yes. They, during Missoul's period as director and then finally dean when we became a school, then we had departments.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, we'd had what amounted to the same thing, really. Hazel Manning was chairman of clothing and textiles, and Ellen Hillstrom was chairman of related art, and Abby herself was chairman of foods and nutrition.
Well, if they weren't called departments, so what were they referred to as?
I guess just about what they are now, areas of subject matter interest.
I see. Well, now, somewhere along the way, did it happen when Miss Sewell came, the emphasis began to shift to include more of the social sciences?
Yes, and I think, you see, Miss Sewell herself, her emphasis in her training had been education. And she really created a department of education, of home economics education, and of which Julia Dalrymple was chairman for some time, and then left here to go to Ohio. But there you see was where her interest showed up. And she tended to work at strengthening the other areas, saying that foods and nutrition is already strong and well known, and these other areas are the ones that we need to develop in order to have a well-balanced school.
So that was her goal, well-balanced school.
And again, and it did show, I think, to some extent, a greater breadth of interest in developing the school than had been true previously.
Now, what happened about the distribution of courses for a major? You said that earlier under Abby Marlatt.
Well, I think that has persisted. I think that rule persisted. I don't know now what the situation is. There are very few requirements, I think. But we had, of course, I knew more about the requirements in the major for hospital dietitians because I was the advisor for them for a good many years. Then I did the requirements in other areas. I guess Margaret wasn't very typical either. She had more electives then because she didn't take the education courses. She had more electives than a good many students had. I remember Hazel Manning really thought she ought to take the education courses in order to be able to teach, and like her mother, she wasn't going to teach. Anyway, oh no, she was going to, what was she going to do? There was some school for the training in the East where she was going, and I was all ready to send her. Can't think now where it was, but it was in merchandising, and that's what she was going into. And later they did develop here a pretty strong merchandising course under Hazel Pascal, but in the meantime Margaret did the education courses and did teach. But anyway, that as far as I think the curriculum stayed, I think it probably changed, but we still did not allow students to take too much home economics. That is, they couldn't just take.
They still had to have something of a liberal education.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I see. So that didn't change too much. Can you think of any other changes that took place?
Now they did. I think always, in order to graduate in home economics, no matter what their major, they had to have at least one course in all areas. They all had to take one course in related to art. I always said I wasn't very closely related to art. And they had to take one course in clothing construction. And that didn't hurt them, you know. They did know how to mend things a little bit and sew up a simple dress of some kind or something. And I always felt it didn't hurt any dietitian to take a course in clothing construction. And they had to take one course in foods. And take one course in nutrition. And there was a course which had no prerequisites. The fundamental, the basic course had prerequisite of biochemistry and physiology. But I taught a course which had no prerequisites, which students in clothing and textiles and related art and child development, I guess. They did have physiology. But anyway, there were a good number that took this course that had no prerequisites. I've had friends in nutrition who said you can't teach a course in nutrition to students who haven't had biochemistry and physiology. I maintain you can.
Well, seems you did.
And some of them learned something. But there was that rule, I know, but they still could not take, they still had to have a pretty good general education.
Still 40 credits in.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I don't know that it was, I think that persisted probably throughout all the years that I knew about. There have been a good many changes in the last 16 years that I just don't know much about.
Well, we're emphasizing the ones, the years that you had firsthand.
Mm-hmm. Now, occasionally someone would call Frances Zuhl Dr. Zuhl, and she didn't care for that. She said, I made it without. And she didn't want to be given the title that she hadn't earned, and she was quite right. She had been president of the American Home Economics Association. She was the dean here in our school for I've forgotten how many years, and she was a very prominent home economist. She would have made a great women's lib too, because she was all out to get for the women everything that the men had, if they wanted, whatever they. Was not for having women shortchanged. I think I referred to that before.
So she was something of a feminist, even though women's libs didn't exist yet.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
She must have felt that the women needed a champion. Is this true?
Indeed she did, and she was right there. I think that I referred the other to the fact that on one occasion she'd asked for a raise for me, and the current dean, who was Mr. Froker, said, oh, you know, we don't give any after 65. And she said, Mr. Froker, do you think I can't read the papers? Men get them. Women should too.
This is kind of silly to hold the view that after you have all this experience on top of your training that you're not worth more, perhaps, than you were earlier and shouldn't have a raise.
I think that is a strange, if there is such a regulation, if you're not going to be retired until you're 70, I see no reason why you shouldn't get raises between 65 and 70 then. And I don't think there is any such regulation. There couldn't be, or I wouldn't have gotten it.
You did get it?
Yes.
Oh, very good.
Yes, she overruled, you know, she talked him into it. She just said, now you just can't, don't need to tell me that. I can read the papers and I know the men have been getting them. And Mr. Reynolds has done much the same kind of thing they have. So, you can't discriminate. But she was a real feminist. She was always out to get everything for the women that she could. The women on the campus in other areas, I think, were inclined to say that she did a great deal for women on the campus because they could say, look at what the women in home economics are getting. It wasn't that our salaries were so fabulous, but they were better than they were on the Hill for the women. And on the whole, and they would use us as an illustration and put the pressure on and for the women and on the whole, and they would use us as an illustration and put the pressure on and helped all of them.
Well, that's very good.
When Extension was trying to get their own freestanding building. You know, back in the earlier days of home economics, we had the that would be the east wing or the south wing. Which direction is it? Anyway, as you face the building, the one on the right.
East, I think.
Yes, was what we had, and Extension occupied the center of the building. And then during Missoula's regime, we got a new wing, but we still had Extension in the middle. And the men at the university club were saying, if Extension had Francis Zuhl for a dean, they'd get their building.
Well, ultimately, of course, they did, but not right off.
And then we got the whole building eventually.
Did that must have helped the...
Oh, yes, that helps, but, you know, they're still crowded.
It's still crowded.
It doesn't seem to make much difference how much space you have. You need more. They have now have some offices over in the Steenbach Library. There are some offices in the basement there, and some of them are occupied by some of the home economics staff.
I didn't know that. So they're still...
They're still crowded.
They're still crowded. Well, I guess in home economics that you can't very well compare the load of the women with the load of the men, because I imagine that still while you were there, there weren't very many women, very many men in the field.
No, there were. I remember when a young man enrolled in one of my courses, someone from ag school, I think he was, may have been from biochem, I don't remember. But he was going to teach somewhere where he had to teach a course in nutrition, in human nutrition. And he came and audited the course that I was teaching. But we didn't have men on the faculty at that time. I don't think that during the time that I was active that there were any men on the faculty. There's, I don't know how many now, several, a good number.
Yes, I think... in that area there are quite a number, and mm-hmm. I've read that there is no problem about their finding jobs when they've graduated, that they're in great demand.
Mm-hmm.
This came as something of a surprise to me. I guess my preconceptions are quite different.
No, back in the Depression days when people were graduating and not getting jobs, the home economics graduates were getting jobs then. We had dietitians and home economics teachers, and they were still keeping home economics in the public schools, so our girls were going out to teach, and a few were doing other things in experimental foods in test kitchens and
one of our graduates, I don't know who's working there now, working for Frauci's, you know, home decoration, that sort of thing. But it was interesting that the home ex were getting jobs when not very many others were.
Well, you when you're talking about the salaries a moment ago, how did you feel about, as a woman on the faculty, about your salary or the salaries in general in the in-home economics as opposed to salaries in other areas of the campus?
I think that ours were better than those of most women on the campus.
How did they compare with the men?
Well, that was the problem, of course, but Frances Zuhl managed to, I don't think our salaries were ever as much as the men were getting, doing pretty much the same thing. I doubt if they are today. But she did a great deal to get them up. And I never worried too much about it, but raises were not, I remember, when I got, it seemed for a period of time, you got $100 a year, that was just sort of standard. And then one year I got 200, and I called Ruth Merland when I got my notice and asked her if it was, there'd been a mistake. I couldn't think that but I guess I didn't ever worry too much about the salary. Not that I'm such a, not so altruistic that I wasn't interested in the salary, but then I liked what I was doing and I just didn't, that salary wasn't the first consideration. I was glad to be here.
Well, would you explain about that a little? What was it about
I had come here
university?
More or less as an experiment, as a graduate student, mainly just to get out on my own after I'd been back at home with this small child. And then when I had an opportunity to stay right here on the faculty, I was very, you know, just pleased to have that opportunity. I was offered out in Bozeman, Montana, Gladys Brannigan Chalkley. She was then Gladys Brannigan, was the head of home economics out there, and she, after I got my master's, she wrote me and offered me a position there. And I guess I may have told you this before, I went in and talked to Miss Marlatt about it. She said, well, you might be able to use some of your own ideas if you have any, which I doubt a little. Anyway, my parents were so pleased that I was going to stay right here. It was not too far from Wyoming, Iowa, where they lived, and they were just delighted that I was staying here. And you see, also, I was within 25 miles of the Reynolds family, which made it attractive too.
Oh, certainly. Mm-hmm. So I
stayed.
That was that for Montana.
Yeah, oh yes. Mm-hmm. Well, and I later learned, as years went by, that you didn't have many opportunities to go elsewhere, because if they wrote asking for people to be recommended for jobs, they didn't recommend you if they wanted you to stay here.
Oh, they just didn't.
So, no, you just didn't. I know one summer I happened to director, we didn't have a dean at that time, I was sort of acting in the main office, and so I saw the mails that came in and realized that there were opportunities to go elsewhere.
That you had never realized.
But which had never been, had never come my way at all. But then, I don't know that it would have, I wouldn't have been any better off somewhere else. I was happy here. Wisconsin, I think I would have to say, it's been good to me. I've had a good life here.
One thing that interested me, you said that you didn't go ahead and work for your PhD for a number of years. You were a member of the faculty. Why was that? Or why did you finally decide to?
The same pressure. I got the master's and I was teaching. I liked what I was doing. And there was not the pressure for the PhD that there is now. I wouldn't have been allowed to go on teaching and maybe doing a little research, but not much under present conditions. But back at that time, I finished my master's in about 24, and there wasn't the pressure for another degree. And I did occasionally take a course. I remember when Professor Hart was giving a course called Modern Developments in Nutrition and Their Applications, or some such title as that. And Miss Parsons suggested that I go down and take it. Well, Gus boasted in animal husbandry, and was a man in poultry for years. Anyway, a good number of faculty people who were ranking faculty were there to take that, to listen in on this course. And it was great. We had wonderful discussions. And Professor Hart was a marvelous teacher. And you never could tell when he was going to point the finger at you with some question that was practical, but not necessarily easy to answer. But I've never forgotten that course. Then when I finally decided that I must go ahead and get that next degree, that course was, of course, on my record, and as were some other things that I'd taken from time to time, which turned out to be very helpful. It cut down the required courses that I had to take. And I don't know really what did finally make me decide that I had to get a PhD. May Coles and Helen Parsons had come back from, May had gone to the University of Chicago and Helen to Yale. They had come back with their PhDs sometime earlier and were the only people in home economics with PhDs at that time. And I don't really know why I finally decided that I should do it. And I went in to talk to Miss Parsons about it. And she had said on more than one occasion that she didn't feel that everyone needed to go ahead for a PhD degree. And she wouldn't encourage everyone to do it. So I didn't know whether I should do it or not. So I went in and talked to her, and she gave me some encouragement. Then I think I told you before, I went in and talked to Abby, my lad, about it, and she said she hoped it wouldn't spoil a good teacher.
Yes, I remember.
But you see, some of those things you cherish.
Yes.
Then, you see, I went, really did my work in Harry Steenbach's laboratory.
For your degree?
For my PhD. I had taken coursework with him, but I did my master's thesis with Elmer Severinghouse in the medical school. And but then when I went for the PhD, I've always appreciated Helen Parsons' attitude. I was working in his laboratory, but I was going back and forth sort of between the two. And she said, "Now, don't consider what I tell you you should do. You're working in his laboratory, so you do what he wants you to." You know, she didn't, she wanted to be sure that I wasn't in any, didn't get myself in any bind because I was a joint major and working kind of back and forth. I think that I did say the other day that there were three of us who were the pioneers, in the this joint major between nutrition and home economics and biochemistry. And we all did our laboratory work in Steenbach's lab. Kyle Bauman was there. Peg Irwin was there. Evelyn Van Donk, who became Mrs. Harry Steenbach eventually, was there. She had been a home ec graduate. She was a home ec graduate. I'd had her as a student.
You had?
And when she finished, she went down there to work as more or less a just a laboratory assistant. And she finally went east to work in the Laterly laboratories. And about that time, Dr. Steenbach's parents died, and he had always lived at home with his parents. And I think he realized that he was missing Evelyn. So then he went east and married her.
Just like that.
He was, you know, a very eligible bachelor for a good many years.
I see. Well, it's curious how things happen.
Yes.
Did it take you, how did you find it that you were teaching at the same time that you were doing your...
Oh, yes, it took me forever.
Classwork.
To the point where I thought I never would get the thesis written. See, I was finally on a half-time basis. I was living in the home management house as the instructor there. And going over to the biochem laboratory to feed the white rats all and weigh them and take the data and so on. And then Ms. Marlatt said, I have to have you back on full time. She hadn't found, it certainly was not true that there weren't other people in the world who could have taught the same course, but she hadn't happened to find them. And so she said, I just think you ought to come back on full time. At the same time, I was having some financial problems and had made some comment to Dr. Steenbach, some in the lab, I don't know, just incidentally, and he had said, well, you could just as well go back on full time. We'll hire more help here so that your work can continue and you can go back and teach full time and have your full salary. So it worked out very well because it turned out that they needed me, and so I was back on full time for some time before I finished the degree. And as I said, I thought I'd never get the thesis written. It finally was finished and accepted. Miss Marlatt walked me across the platform to get, in those days they were still hooding the PhDs. I've always said I thought I had a greater hand when I got my degree than anyone who ever got a PhD, because all of these home economics seniors who were sitting down there had lived in the home management house with me while I was writing the thesis.
Oh, boy.
And so they sort of suffered through it with me. And so when it was finally conferred, I think they were just as glad as I was.
I bet. Well, then, degree in hand, what effect, if any, did this have?
Well, I'd been back on full time, and I don't think it had much of any. Maybe I got a little raise in salary, I'm not sure.
I was wondering if anything like that came
I
with.
I did, but it was, when I went back on full time, I think I just got twice what I'd been getting for half time, and I just don't remember that I got any great raise because I finished the degree. And there was not the same kind of emphasis, you know. There wasn't the pressure. I think that I commented about the fact that at one time, Capital Times published the names of the 13 women on the faculty who were full professors.
You mentioned that there were 13 at one time.
Yeah, well, that was the list was published in the Capital Times.
And I think half of them were in home economics.
Well, that doesn't surprise me too much. How do you feel about the emphasis that we have today on a PhD?
I think it's foolish. PhD is a research degree, and they insist on a PhD in a situation where there's no opportunity, no funds, no time for research. And yet, they require a PhD to fill a position. And that seems to me still to be ridiculous, because to get a PhD, you get this training in research, and then you find yourself in a situation where you don't use it. A friend of mine was recently approached for to fill an opening in at Stevens Point in university there, and she was going to have to be put on as an instructor because she doesn't have a PhD. She's had a good many years of teaching experience, but she's never secured that last degree. And so that she, if she had taken that position, she would have gone there as an instructor, although she had better rank than that where she is. But that was the best that Agnes Jones could do, because it was the rule of the university system. And Agnes Jones said, we don't expect people to do any research. Stevens Point is a teaching institution. But, and they still were holding on to the PhD. And these, I think, currently, if you expect to do college teaching, you better get that PhD, because you'll not make any progress without it.
I have the impression this is true in most fields, actually.
Oh, I think so. Oh, I don't think
not
uniformly. Just in nutritional science or in home economics. Oh, no, I think it was probably true in some of the other fields before it was in some of the areas of home ec, because there's still a good many people teaching in the school here in the clothing and textiles and related art, where the situation is somewhat different. And I think they still don't, not nearly all of the staff there have a PhD. But I think they're going to have to face it.
I think we talked a little last time, going back a bit, to Abby Malott's concern with the science aspect of home economics requirement, and the fact that under Ms. Zuhl, at least that seems to me to have been the beginning of more concern with the social sciences.
With what?
With the social sciences.
Well, possibly. I think that we would have to give Ms. Malott credit for having a good deal of vision when she really started this, what was then a department in the College of Agriculture, because she limited the amount of home economics courses that students could take. She wanted them to have a good general education.
Yes.
Though she herself had come up through chemistry, so she was quite interested in a strong science background. But at the same time, students were expected to take English literature and sociology and psychology and economics and so on, and get a good general education along with their home economics.
You did point that out.
Yes, and then when Frances Zuhl came here, I think her big contribution was to get facilities for the school.
Mm-hmm.
We had only one wing and not very good laboratories. They were remodeled. She got preschool lab, a new home management house, and the new wing, and in addition, you know, it just improved our physical plant
Yes.
That was her big contribution.
Well, now how do you see, what do you think is developments since she retired?
Well, they had some problems. They had, there were a couple of people appointed as deans who were not, well, three actually.
I wonder if you discuss that period a bit.
Well, I was not here through most of it, but do you want names?
Please.
Josephine Staub came. She was brought here to be dean. She is a perfectionist, and she was unable to assign responsibilities to other people, with the result that she simply could not do it. And finally, she resigned as dean and was made a professor in family economics, stayed on the faculty, but she resigned as dean. Then Rita Humans, whose background was in home economics education, was appointed. And for some reason, she couldn't do it either. I don't know what was so horrendous about the school. We were still in the College of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And of course, my own contacts with Dean Pound have been very pleasant. So I'm not inclined to blame him for having made it so difficult. But at any rate, Rita couldn't do it either. So she resigned. Then Bill Marshall was brought here, and he had everything going his way.
He did.
He had the faculty all for him. But he himself, this is a rough statement, but he himself had no integrity. They could not trust anything that he told them.
Hmm.
He would talk to one member of the faculty about another. He would talk to faculty or to students about faculty until the faculty finally rebelled and went to Dean Pound, and with the result that Dean Pound just plain fired him from, he couldn't be fired as a professor, he's still on the faculty, but he, because he had tenure, but
he was fired as dean, I recall that.
But he was
that.
Plain fired as dean.
That I even know more or less when that happened, I think.
Yes. And they had an acting dean for a year, a woman who had been dean of the School of Nursing and didn't know anything about home economics, and I think cared less. But she was acting dean for a year. And then I guess that it was after that the current dean was brought here.
Yes, well, now Marshall, I guess, was removed as dean in about 1973. That's fairly recently.
Yes, and then Cioni, who was the who'd been dean of School of Nursing, was an acting dean. And how long has Dean Simpson been here? At any rate, in the meantime, the school was made autonomous, with taken out of the College of Agriculture, and that put it up to the administration, general university administration, to find a dean, and they brought Elizabeth Simpson, who was in Washington, and in education in some capacity. I don't know exactly what her appointment in Washington was, but she was brought here from Washington, D.C., and she is a very good person, and is. In the meantime, nutritional science had withdrawn from, and foods and nutrition, had withdrawn from the school. So we have a Department of Nutritional Science
in the College of Agriculture, and the people in the foods area went to the food science over in the dairy industry building.
Well, now how did this come about? I was going to ask about
I don't,
that.
I was not here. I've never felt that it was good, and so I'm not, I really shouldn't comment on it, I guess, because, I think among the people in nutrition felt that their students were being required to take too much other home economics, and they felt they had to have so much background in the sciences and in math and statistics and so on, that they just didn't have time to be taking courses in clothing construction and related art and so on. And I think too, Dr. Harper visualized a Department of Nutritional Science, which would include not only the people who had been in nutrition in home economics, but pulling out from biochem some who'd been fundamentally interested in nutrition, men in animal husbandry who were interested in nutrition, poultry husbandry, the nutritional science, people interested in nutrition on the campus, and getting them together into one department, which he has done to a considerable extent, I think. He has brought in, as he's brought in new people, he's brought in biochemists. The women who were in home economics and who went into the Department of Nutritional Science are still the only women there. That's not quite true. I guess there was at least one other brought in. But he's brought in biochemists. I think he has a good department, and they're doing a good job, but they're not in the school.
Now, why do you think this is a mistake?
Well, I think from the standpoint of the school, it's weakening, because we have a strong foods and nutrition department, and with a good deal of research going on, and it was BioOdds, the largest department in the school. And I think when this move was made, the idea in the minds, at least of the women in home economics, was that